Welcome to the Scientist Podcast, the show for anyone wanting to understand the realities of research life. We bring you into the lives of top academics so that you can get to know the people behind the research that's shaping our world. I'm Jamie, your host, and in this podcast, I'll be bringing you candid conversations each week with those on the cutting edge of their fields. Hey everyone, and welcome to the Scientist Podcast. As always, I hope you're really well. Today, I'm talking to a researcher who, amongst other things, specializes in the psychology of shark conservation and sustainability citizen science. She also runs the hugely popular Doctor of What, a blog that maps and documents the experience of PhD students. With no further ado, I'm really pleased to introduce Dr. Brianna Lebosque. Brianna, how are you?
Good, thank you, Jamie. Thank you so much for having me on tonight.
No, it's great to have you, and there's so much to talk about. But I want to start with the role of psychology and marketing, and particularly the marketing that people come across every day. You know, you've spent time working in industry and actually applying a range of psychological theories in industry. And the first question, or two questions rather, what were you applying and were there any interesting conclusions?
Yeah, great question. So while I was finishing up my PhD, I went and worked in market research for a while. And I guess firstly, it's important to understand that psychology is really about understanding people and in a really simplistic way, being able to change people's behaviours, which is also what marketing tries to do. So it makes sense that there's that big overlap there. I was fortunate enough, a lot of the theories that I applied were more around understanding attitudes and understanding the influence that attitudes have on behaviour. Most commonly, I used the theory of planned behaviour, which is a well-known theory in psychology, particularly from health psychology, that looks at how attitudes and also perceived behaviour control can influence behaviours. And I found in just my short time in market research that that mapped really well, including on donation behaviour, so whether people would donate to charities, whether people would buy a particular product. So it was quite a consistent finding there.
Can you talk a little bit more about the theory itself?
Yeah, so the theory is basically the idea that attitudes, perceived behaviour control, influence behavioural intentions. It's really hard to measure actual behaviours. A lot of the time we can't sort of be following somebody around and finding out whether they're actually doing the behaviour that they want. But we know in theory, it's really well established that if people have an intention to perform a behaviour, they usually do. There are sometimes barriers, but for the most part, intentions do translate to behaviours.
Yeah, so it's interesting because marketing firms, I guess, if they acknowledge it or not, are all playing the psychology game. They're all trying to influence behaviour and they're all trying to, therefore, I guess, beforehand, it's predicated on understanding behaviour, which makes me wonder why, and maybe there are, full-time psychologists, behaviour specialists, etc., in the context of marketing. Is that something that happens?
Really interestingly, not as much as it should and not as much that I think it will in the future. I worked in a small firm and there were two of us who had a psych background. I did read an article actually on LinkedIn that's predicting that behavioural scientists will become a lot more prevalent in marketing because once a marketing firm gets someone with a psychology degree, I think they start to realise just how vital that actually is. And there's a lot of overlap between marketing and psychology, definitely.
I've just watched The Social Dilemma on Netflix, and it showed that sort of Facebook and Twitter were being quite cynical in their understanding of human behaviour and dopamine systems and attention to try and get our attention to the best degree that they could. There's something quite Black Mirror or 1984, to be extreme about it, about that process. And I think that cynicism on one level is well-founded. Where do you see the line with marketing and psychology? Because clearly everyone's playing it, whether they're realizing it or not. So it's not a case of it's all terrible. It's more a case of there are instances where it's cynical and there are instances where it's not.
Completely. And I think it's really interesting that you brought up The Social Dilemma, and a lot of that was the biological aspect, which there's definitely an overlap between that and psychology, but behavioural psychology is more so focusing on attitudes and knowledge. So I guess there's sort of a little bit different between those two as well. I think, and I'm obviously a psychology researcher, so I guess I'm biased in that, but psychology is heavily underpinned by ethics. All through our undergraduate and all through our research degree, we have a very good understanding of ethics. There's a lot of infamous old 70s psychology experiments that has meant that we sit through a lot of ethical lectures. So I guess I almost think that if we fully embrace that there is this overlap between marketing and psychology, we can not only use the psychology principles, which when you think about it, is a little bit creepy almost, that it's fully just trying to manipulate behaviours, but we can also bring on board the ethical considerations of psychology as well. So that's where I hope that I see it going.
I know what you mean, and you're right. If you're talking about, in this case, attitudes, it feels one removed from controlling behaviours. And I don't think people are so upset about the idea in theory of, well, I'm interested in how marketing will change my attitude towards something. We change our attitudes all the time, and in some ways we're grateful to change our attitudes. It's the behavior control, or I think maybe in the most extreme case, hence the social dilemma, control on our attention. That seems to be, for whatever reason, psychologically the line. Whether that's founded or unfounded and these distinctions actually exist, I don't know. But I think that makes sense. Moving on slightly, let's talk about sustainability citizen science. And before we dive into the sustainability, how do you characterize citizen science itself?
Yeah, so citizen science is basically employing general members of society to actually be a part of the research process. So really simplistically, it's the idea that we develop these projects where we can actually get people who are interested in the area, they can go out and collect the data, or in some cases actually be involved in the data analysis as well. It isn't just in the field of sustainability, although that's a really big part of it, but citizen science are also prevalent in health research and astronomy research as well.
Yeah, there seems to be a very natural overlap between the ethics and ethos of sustainability and community movements, etc. You know what that reminds me of? I can't remember exactly how it linked to COVID, but there was some idea that you could use the computing power on your phone overnight and kind of put it towards supercomputers, etc., who were doing some algorithmic work on COVID. And I thought there was something quite inspiring about that, you know, utilizing everyday people for science. Because I guess if science is all about testing hypotheses and collecting data, getting people involved is great. Are the people who tend to get involved in sustainability science academics, or do they tend to be people with an interest in the topic of sustainability?
A little bit of a mixed bag. I have actually done research looking at, I guess, the demographics of some citizen science who were involved in sustainability. And overall, they were quite highly educated. So most of them had held at least an undergraduate degree, but they weren't working in academia or science. So most of them are just interested in, depends on the project itself. Sometimes the project might be in a particular location and they're attached to that location itself. Some of them might be with a particular species. So it was more about, I guess, passion for the topic more so than passion for science.
Yeah, it's interesting. We talk a lot on this podcast about inclusivity in science and accessibility in science. And this almost feels like, in terms of getting the public involved and people who are interested, feels like a very good way to realize, oh, science is actually something that I can do. It's not for men in lab coats.
Definitely. And not only that, but it also actually means that we have more data and we have more resources to collect better data and actually have better science projects as well. So there's sort of benefits to the citizen scientists involved and benefits to the project as well. So overall, really good outcomes.
Is there a project you want to talk about specifically that's been kind of the best example of this working?
There's been a lot. I haven't been involved in a project super recently, and obviously a lot of the projects have been on hold recently as well. A girl who I've met a few times at different science events, she's been running an echidna project here in South Australia that's been immensely popular, and people have actually gone out and collected echidna poop and sent it on to her, and she has found some really interesting findings from that. So that one's probably my favorite.
Yeah, it's cool. It's like, you know, when you're at school and you do science, there's a period until you're about 15 where science is really fun because it's experiments and it's light and it's adventurous and it's all of the rest. And you know, you're getting involved in collecting data, and then you hit 17, unless you're scientifically inclined, which I appreciate the majority of our audience probably are. I can speak as someone sort of on the other side and say all of a sudden you're hit with the fact that electrons don't exist in 2-8-8 orbitals and really it's all more complicated. And I imagine that's maybe why it's not a requirement to love the details of the further academia of science to get involved here. It's about the discovery, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, definitely.
Listen, I want to talk a little bit about your blog here, because it's a great read for anyone who hasn't yet seen it. I really recommend it. It's called The Doctor of What. And there's a couple of posts that sort of caught my eye. The first was a post called The Seasons of Academia. And this is where you describe how the seasons get divided up for academics and how it feels as the year goes on, basically. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that and how maybe the rhythm of the calendar is perhaps different for academics than those outside academia.
Yeah, firstly, thank you for mentioning the blog. It's definitely been a really big passion project of mine. I'm in my first year, I guess, as an academic now that I'm working full-time in academia. And we went to a seminar with a few people who have been working in academia for a long time. And after that, I guess I just realized that academia is quite unique, I think, and we don't follow necessarily calendar years or months. It's much more, I think, about our outputs within those months. And so much about academia is about our teaching evaluations or our citations or our grants. And I guess just started to reflect on how different times of the year can feel really different and how it's really important to move through those seasons and acknowledge that hopefully when we have sort of a really dark winter with no citations and there's no publications, hopefully we're sort of working towards spring. And I guess I wrote from that perspective of what comes around goes around in academia, and it's kind of this cyclical process, I guess.
I have to ask, in the professional world, academia no exception, people often sort of check in with themselves. How is this going? How am I getting on? Is this going well? Am I feeling valued? Am I being successful, quote unquote? And the quality of that internal check-in depends on what you're doing. If you're a consultant, it's have I got any big clients? It's am I going to get a promotion? As an academic, what is the check-in? Is it citations? Is it how teaching's going? What's the deal?
It does depend on the contract you have in academia in terms of if you are more research focused or more teaching focused. But I think generally the three things we look at are teaching evaluations, publications and citations of those publications, and also any grants or money that you bring into the uni as well. It's sort of those three distinct success points, I guess.
Okay, and let's talk about the universities, because when I grew up, I watched a lot of American movies. And universities are something that people really feel like fraternal with. And then you go to university in the UK and there's just total apathy isn't quite right, but it's like the university doesn't exist as an institution that you get behind. It would almost be a little bit like in a high school way, slightly uncool, you know? I wonder, yeah, as a researcher or as an academic rather, are you like, oh, brilliant, this is the university that's given me a very highly competitive position and we'll talk about the competitiveness. I feel a real association with them. Or is it like, this is a job, and really if somewhere else offered me something slightly better, clearly I'd go. What's the situation with loyalty to universities? I always wonder this.
It's hard to answer. And I think I agree, sort of growing up and watching American movies and American TV shows, it does seem like there's that real affiliation to the college there. I think in Australia, we don't have that heavy loyalty. My understanding is people will often go where their research is best or where there's sort of a supervisor or a mentor who's in that area. So I think we're more affiliated probably with our research areas than with a university itself.
Yeah, that makes sense, right? Because you build a community within the group of people you're doing papers with and you're learning from and the supervisors, rather than the actual buildings and institutions in which it takes place.
Yeah.
When there's a winter, metaphorically and maybe literally, in these seasons of academia, what does that look like? Does that look like teaching is feeling difficult and there aren't any citations and it's really, really competitive? And like anything that's really, really competitive, you can kind of quasi forget that fact and it's going really well. And then as soon as you run into difficulty, you're like, whoa, this is hard. Is that kind of how it looks?
Definitely. I think for me, the biggest thing is the lack of publications and the lack of citations. And probably even further than that, it's actually getting the rejections on the publications. And I think if you get a couple of those in quite a short period, that's when it really feels like winter for me.
Right, yeah. And what's the success rate tends to be, broad brush, interquartile rangey type stuff, when we're talking about like publication success rates?
I know that in my areas, so I often either publish sort of in the psychology area, or because my research is in conservation, it's in that area. The rough number, it changes a little bit, but it's about an 85% rejection rate. So not a very big acceptance. Yeah.
Every time I speak to an academic, I go away thinking, oh my God, how are you doing this year round? 85%.
Yeah. The first one hurts, and then you kind of get used to it.
And these are also not things that don't require any emotional involvement. There's an emotional investment here in writing a paper that you think is right for publishing.
Definitely. And I think particularly when you're trying to publish things like your PhD thesis that you spend years working on, there's a particularly big investment.
Yeah. And actually, like, if you do a job that has a fair amount of separation between what you're interested in and the job, that's not a state of affairs that anybody particularly aspires to. But one big advantage is that it doesn't feel so personal. Whereas if you've been waking up in the morning every day for 3 years, 4 years, thinking, this is what we're working on, this is my PhD, this is my area of particular interest, this is what I want to develop with my life, this is my contribution to the human project. And it's like, rejection, sorry, these are the improvements. Ouch.
Yeah.
This podcast episode is sponsored by BioBox Analytics. BioBox is a data analytics platform designed for scientists and clinicians working with next-generation sequencing data. With BioBox, you can design and run bioinformatic pipelines on demand, generate publication-ready plots, and discover insights using popular public databases. Spots are limited, so sign up for the waitlist and be the first to access a free account at biobox.io.
Well, we should talk about it then, competitiveness in academia. Because I think one of the things that drives so much of the culture in academia are the numbers, the fact that there are more people wanting jobs than there are jobs by far, double that for tenure track positions, double that for, you know, a limited amount of funding for the research that you want to do. How does that influence the culture and the underlying assumptions that run the interactions in academia?
I think it probably impacts it even more than we understand or more than we would like to acknowledge. But you're right, I think academia itself is built on competition. Everything that we do is a competition in a sense. For me in particular, moving into and being a really new academic, you do realize that you are competing against your colleagues, and a lot of the time they're your friends, they're the people that you share an office with and sit next to. But we are competing, and a lot of that competition is based on numbers as well. It's not necessarily being able to go to an interview and argue something. It's about your publication numbers. So it's a really sort of black and white competition. I think it fuels not a toxic culture, but I think it can make it happy. And you really have to reflect and make sure that, you know, you're not being jealous and you're not letting that jealousy and competitive nature, I don't know, make you not be a nice colleague. I think it's a really hard line, and it's one that I'm definitely still, I guess, on the journey towards understanding.
Yeah, it's so interesting how incentives are set up, because if you're being set up to need to be publishing and churning out X number of papers a year, and you know that that's basically the criteria for succeeding in this competition, just to say, it must be quite hard to be quote unquote nice, brilliant, unjealous all of the time. I mean, on your blog, you wrote something I really liked. It was, correct me if I'm wrong here, a Taylor Swift lyric: don't be so clever you forget to be nice, and don't be so nice you forget to be clever. I'm sure she was writing particularly about conservation academia. And it's nice that she picked up this nuance.
Yeah, definitely. I know. I'm sure she read Dr. Rapport, of course. It really hit home to me, particularly one of my mentors. She was just saying that you have to consider who you bring onto publications and consider who you're going to get onto a project. And she basically said that, you know, you can't be too nice. But I find that hard as well, because I think that in the end of the day, we might be working with these people for years, if not decades. And I would hate for it to just be based on competition and jealousy either. We have to get a balance there.
How egalitarian is academia? Because if it's about publishing numbers, presumably those who have lots of publishing numbers can leverage their existing publishing numbers to then get further positions, which lo and behold allows them to publish.
Definitely. I think that's my understanding so far, sort of being a newbie academic. That's definitely how I see it. And I think that's where the competition is particularly fierce in early academia, because you have to get that step up to be able to then roll on and roll on.
Which is weird, right? Because you've just done a PhD and you get to walk around and say you're a doctor, because you are a doctor. And that's one of the coolest things you can probably do. And then you get there and you're like, I mean, I guess you don't expect it because you know what the situation is as you go in. But one outside that level of academia might expect you sort of put your feet up and you're on the beach then. You know, you're a doctor now if you've done the hard bit. And it turns out, no, this is where the quote-unquote ultra marathon starts.
Definitely. And I think that that's something that even whilst you're doing a PhD, you don't realise. And it's a different type of fast-paced, I think. A PhD is quite fast-paced, even though it takes average of 4 years, but it's quite fast-paced. And I do feel like I have more time to take a breath in academia, but you do when you finish the PhD and then you start academia and you realise that the finish line is so much further in front of you than it was before.
So speaking of research and publications, let's talk psychology of sharks, or shark conservation rather. Because when I hear the phrase psychology of shark conservation, the first thing I'm thinking of is sharks are really scary, or they're supposed to be depicted as really scary. So is the psychology of shark conservation to do with changing attitudes as not dissimilar to marketing, or is it to do with something else?
Definitely. So that was a huge part of my thesis, was understanding people's fears and understanding people's attitudes towards sharks. And in particular, I focus a lot on media portrayals of sharks. What I've found is that the more the media talks about sharks, the more common we think it is that we might get bitten by a shark. So that's a lot of what my thesis was looking at.
Right. Whereas if sharks don't get mentioned at all, does that disproportionately make them less scary? But, you know, people aren't forgetting sharks exist, I guess. So it's interesting that just the mention of them seems to exacerbate that one particular quality, i.e., you know, the quote unquote scary nature of sharks.
It's quite well established that sharks are common in the media, particularly here in Australia, where we are an island. So we have a lot of beach culture and we do have a higher number of shark encounters than what other countries do. And initial understandings of this is that the more we hear about something, just the more common we think it is. So that's not just to do with sharks, but in Australia, sharks dominate a lot of the media here.
That's so interesting. Why? Do we have jaws to blame, or is it because they're just superficially really massive, interesting, beautiful creatures? What's the reason that sharks get such a mention when really shark incidents and probably even shark sightings of any note aren't that common?
Yeah, so there's a few hypotheses as to why. The jaws effect is still definitely there. There's quite a bit of research to suggest that although jaws came out in 1970, so it was a long time ago now, that idea of a man-eating shark and this monster shark is still what a lot of the media actually use. And often in Australia, they'll even use the terminology jaws when they're describing a shark. So we definitely can blame jaws in part. And what sort of the literature suggests is that the media obviously wants to make money and wants to get clicks. And for whatever reason, sharks get clicks because they are big. And if we're talking about a particular shark encounter that could be quote unquote scary, people are going to click on that. And so they're going to keep posting about it.
Yeah, you know what this reminds me a little bit of? I was having a conversation the other day about how Avatar came out and at the time was the highest grossing movie ever. And it left no cultural impact, no cultural footprint. I don't know anyone who can tell me the characters' names. And it was this massive production and was so successful. Whereas Jaws came out in 1970 and was a comparatively speaking low budget affair. And we're talking 50 years later. And this is, it's writing headlines for Australian journalists. I wonder about what the psychology is when something becomes like part of the culture or leaves such a cultural footprint. I wonder, I mean, I don't know if it's something that you've thought about. I always suspect if something, especially with music, sums up a period of time, it has this nostalgia effect, which kind of gives it legs. I wonder if that's something that there is an area of research on.
Yeah, so interesting. It's definitely not something that I've looked into, but I agree. I think that nostalgia with Jaws would also be there. I think that people remember watching Jaws when they were young, or even I think people who were born long after Jaws came out, they still sort of watch it. It's part of childhood or part of early adulthood, and it is really ingrained in the culture there. And I think just for whatever reason, it was sort of a perfect storm of when Jaws came out. It was the most popular film. And then I think enough shark encounters actually happened since that it sort of built on and they were able to use Jaws as an explanation for that.
Yeah, and there's a couple of interesting psychological principles here. So like, that's a pretty good instance of confirmation bias. You know, you start with the existing premise that sharks are, and then every incident of it kind of confirms it. But then I guess the other thing that comes to mind here is, in terms of the evolutionary psychology, and it's not something I know anything about as a caveat, is it's not a surprise in some ways that we're fascinated by big predators. It seems like we might be fairly well built for being fascinated by big predators. Do either of those check out, or is that pop psychology?
No, it definitely does. So in terms of why we're afraid of sharks, there is definitely an evolutionary purpose to that. Same as why people are afraid of spiders or people are afraid of snakes. So there is definitely that, as you said, evolutionary aspect. I think what's interesting is why we fear sharks more than other things that actually have a more statistical chance of hurting us. And I think that's where the media has an influence, where it's innate for us to fear sharks, but the level of fear that people feel is probably somewhat influenced by the media.
Yeah, what's the stat that always gets wheeled out here? I think it's people killed by vending machines every year, right? That's the one.
Also, apparently, popping champagne corks, more people die from that than sharks.
Yeah, exactly. That's sort of the other go-to. Why is it beyond the media and jaws that people are so fearful of sharks disproportionately? Because mosquitoes kill, a genuinely horrific number of people every year. And obviously there's amazing work being done to combat malaria, et cetera, et cetera. But when one sees a mosquito, even if they're somewhere where there's potentially malaria around, it doesn't have this visceral reaction. Why are sharks kind of so on the defense here? Why do they have such a PR problem?
It's such a good question and something that we don't completely understand yet. There is an idea that in part it could be the ocean itself as well. And people do have a fear of the ocean, and particularly swimming where it's deep in the ocean. And so that could further be sort of exacerbating the fear of sharks, because you can only encounter a shark if you're in the ocean. So that's one of the ideas. But we need to understand this further. It's really interesting you brought up mosquitoes, because one of the big arguments is that humans like cute furry animals and we don't like slimy, scaly animals. That doesn't answer why we're more afraid of sharks than mosquitoes, because we have this gross factor about insects as well. So it's a really fascinating area that I think we're only just beginning to understand.
I would be remiss if I didn't get the chance to ask a doctor of psychology about some of the psychology around COVID. And by this, I'm talking about vaccinations, the psychology of why some people, especially seemingly conservative people, have a resistance to it, whether it's something in terms of COVID itself that we get fatigue from, and we get lockdown fatigue, and how long we can kind of feel united in the way that Australia and New Zealand, maybe even to a greater extent, have felt united, etc. So to start with vaccines, why is it that conservatives seem to, on the whole, be slightly more anti-vaccine than quote-unquote liberals? Now, that's not true across the board, of course, but I'm just interested in whether it's people who tend conservative and why it is.
It's something that I probably don't know as much as I should about. I've definitely been quite interested in the media's influence in this space as well, and in particular, social media influence of people's ideas around the vaccination. But I think overall, some of the things like you mentioned before, confirmation bias, I think those things would in part be part of this as well. And I think that for whatever reason, and something I'm sure there's research on, but I think people do feel this skepticism around science and around medical professions. And then this confirmation bias idea kind of, it all spirals. And I'm not sure why. It's, as you said, I guess stereotypically more of the conservatives, but I suspect confirmation bias has a huge part to play here as well.
Right, and the fact that people of different political inclinations look at different media.
Definitely, and I mean, that's where the social dilemma comes into it again, because I guess that's the really interesting thing about the social dilemma, is that it's just a way that our confirmation bias is fueled even more, because if we Google something, then we get shown similar things, and that's exactly what confirmation bias is in the real world. And, you know, there's so much out there on Google now that you'll be able to find something to support any idea you have. It just depends how far you dig, I guess.
Yeah, it's vaguely mental to me that Facebook, Instagram, Twitter really do have control over our innermost beliefs in quite the way that they do. And there's a whole other conversation about whether that equals they should be regulated. But it is just a fascinating point, and COVID and vaccines make this point really, really well. In terms of social media versus the mainstream media, I'm interested in how this divides up when people are forming their opinions and the psychology of opinion formulation. My sense was that traditionally it was the mainstream media. And if you picked up the newspaper and it said think X, people would tend to think X. But now that the social media, and as you say, you can find anything you want to support any potential hypothetical belief, is it now that social media is actually taking up a greater proportion of our belief formulation, and it invites a skepticism of the traditional influences of mainstream media?
I think definitely. And I think particularly in certain topics, I know there's a large amount of literature looking at sort of thin ideals and our ideals of tanning and those physical appearance ideals. And it seems that because from a young age now you're taught that magazines are photoshopped and movies have special effects, and that's sort of really ingrained in us that that's not real. And then we go and watch or look at an Instagram feed and we think that everything on there is real. And I think the fact that we're not just listening to news anchors or celebrities, I think it does make it feel more real, even though if you think about it, we know that people can post anything they want on Instagram and people can really curate what they want. But because they are, quote, normal people, we seem to be influenced almost more by that.
It's really obvious in some ways that movies aren't real, quote unquote. But also social, I mean, Instagram, for instance, is however many years old, 7 or 8. There's perhaps a delay here, but in 10 years' time, people will grow up going, oh, Instagram, not real. But there's almost a generation gap, right? There's a delay. And the interesting detail there for me is the fact that it's real people, people we can relate to more, makes it therefore more accessible. And therefore, if it's more accessible, perhaps our opinions are kind of formed to a greater degree that way. Is that kind of a decent summary of events?
Definitely. And then I think even more so because we curate our own social media, you know, we follow people who we're interested in and people who we like and topics that we like. And although to some extent we can get that in the traditional media, obviously we're shown whatever the traditional media wants to show us, everyone's getting the same. If everyone in Australia who is watching the ABC News is getting that same news, whereas on our Instagram, we're actually curating what we're seeing. And my feed is completely different to another person's feed. And I think that's where confirmation bias becomes really prominent because we're just looking at what we want to look at.
Brianna, thank you so much. That was so much fun. Sorry to have jumped you around on topics as diverse as sharks and citizen science, but you were brilliant and I really appreciate the time.
No, thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun.
Everyone listening, please go and check out Brianna's blog, Doctor of What. It's great and it's accessible and it's a lot of fun. And thank you for listening to the Scientist Podcast. As always, we'll be here next week and we really appreciate you listening.